So you came in 1978.
Yeah. Would you like me to tell my story?
Yes.
Okay. I will tell you the story of how I was hired at San Diego State. Well, first of all, and I only learned this subsequent, I was not on the shortlist to be interviewed. My friend Pat Huckle, who should be interviewed and I will mention that she's got stories that would really be very helpful, very interesting. My friend Pat and a wonderful professor named Lois Kessler, who died last year and was one of the faculty associates at the time. She was in health sciences, and she was one of the original faculty who turned her class over to become a women's studies class back in 70. Pat and Lois were not on the hiring committee, but they told me that they weren't satisfied with the choices that they saw for the final list. So they went back through the pile of applications, and they pulled mine out. And I am convinced that one of the reasons why they noticed mine was because one of the things that I listed on my CV was that I had worked on Lavender Woman in Chicago. I didn't say anything about what Lavender Woman was, but anybody with any insight would know that that was a lesbian newspaper.
I see. Yeah.
And I think that that was a strong reason why they thought that I should get interviewed. So somehow they convinced the hiring committee to put me on the short list. And so I ended up getting interviewed. And I came here. I had been, as I said, I'd been traveling. I had nothing with me. So I went to Filene's basement in Boston.
Yeah, yeah.
And I found a three-piece navy blue skirt suit, skirt, jacket, and vest for $20. I still remember how much it cost. I had not worn a skirt since maybe 1970, except for when I had to be a bridesmaid at my sister's wedding and my sister-in-law's wedding. And I haven't worn, by the way, a skirt since. So I came in the navy blue three-piece skirt suit, and I did a really good interview. And at the dinner, at the end of the day, they had a lot of students who came to the dinner, and there were like 25 people at the dinner, and we went to a Chinese restaurant. Two things happened at this dinner. The first is that the students were talking about how much they wanted a course on lesbians, and I said, oh, I could do that. The second thing that happened is that 25 people sitting around a great big round table at a Chinese restaurant, half an hour of, well, should we order this or should we order that? And I said, I'll order for us. And I ordered the whole dinner. I got the job offer. Well, actually, the fact is, they offered it to somebody else who turned it down. I was the second person to get the job offer. And I took it. And I think partly it was because while they weren't going to say that they wanted a lesbian, they really wanted a lesbian. They were getting a lot of pressure from the students because the entire faculty was heterosexual and there had never been a lesbian. And I think they also thought that I'd become a good department chair someday because I could order
Chinese
for 25 people.
I think that's a good indicator.
So I got the job. And I do have this to say about that navy blue suit. Almost 10 years later, I was still the only lesbian. Almost 10 years later, we were recruiting and for a position, and we brought in a candidate who we thought might be a lesbian, but who was very, very cagey and very closeted. And she showed up wearing a three-piece navy blue suit skirt.
How funny.
And we joke still. She's one of my best friends now and, of course, has never been in anything but jeans since.
That's very
and we
funny.
Joke that there was one three-piece navy blue skirt suits circulating around academic lesbians, sort of like the Sisterhood of the Traveling Skirt Suit.
That's marvelous.
Yeah. So that's my hiring story.
That's terrific.
It was great. It was just great being here. And the first year I developed a lesbian studies class. It was
terrific. I noticed also in 1978, I saw your picture in the Follies.
Oh, yes.
Tell me about that.
Well, every year there was a big end of the year, or maybe it was end of the semester party. And, you know, back in those days, the students and the faculty were much closer. There was, first of all, there was less difference in age between us. And it was just more of a community at the time, and I think also maybe we were really not very good about boundaries. I've become much, much stricter about boundaries since the 70s. And there was, so we would always do these, you know, these big parties, and one of the things that was a kind of a constant was the feminist Follies. And the faculty all kind of did skits. So they all decided that they were going to dress up like housewives. So you see people wearing bathrobes and all that stuff.
Yeah.
I said, well, I'm not. I'm a dyke. You know, I'm not going to do that. So I decided to dress as some kind of lesbian stereotype. So that's why I'm in the athletic clothes with the tennis racket. And I read my piece. What I did was I read a poem by Pat Parker called "For the Straight Woman Who Wants to Be My Friend But Doesn't Know How to." And it's just a whole thing about, you know, first you must never forget. First you must always. How does it go? First you must never forget that I'm a lesbian. Second you must always never remember that I'm a lesbian, or something like that. And it was a great poem, which is why I was wearing the costume, which is ironic because I am totally not athletic, but, you know,
I wondered about that.
I didn't have anything else to wear.
That's funny. I noticed that,
yes.
And I was thinking, oh, because there's another part of the exhibit that's all about the sports.
It had nothing to do with that. It was just something that I was thinking of, something that would be kind of lesbian. So I had a great time being the lesbian for a long time.
Yeah. And it was, well, tell me about what it was like in the early 80s here at the university. I mean,
starting only 78 through those first few years. Well, it was
the Ronald Reagan era.
Oh, that didn't matter.
It didn't.
No.
Not, well,
that had no impact. I just remember, I mean, because I was first a lecturer and I was an untenured faculty member for the first few years.
So you weren't dealing with the budget issues at that time.
I didn't deal with any of that
at all.
I knew nothing about that. My world was women's studies.
Yeah.
I had a little bit of, occasionally I was on a few committees, but my world was women's studies. And it was the faculty, it was the students. I mean, it was this network that, and then I was very involved in the community with lesbian organizations and
well,
all
tell
that.
Me about that a little bit, because
it was the same as in Buffalo, it was the same as in Chicago. We had an organization called San Diego Lesbian Organization, SDLO. I was involved with SDLO. There were newspapers. I wrote for the local San Diego newspapers. We went out to the bars. I was fine, you know, having relationships. I mean, it was just, you know, I was young. I was,
yeah,
you know, I had a job.
Yeah.
I was very involved also with NWSA and MLA, the Women's and Lesbian Caucuses of MLA. So, you know, I was going to conferences. I have letters. One of these days I have to put my letters in order. I was corresponding with academics and, you know, lesbian and feminist academics all over the country.
Oh,
in
that's
the days
interesting.
Before email, when we wrote letters.
That's wonderful to have them, yeah.
I don't write letters anymore. So it was just a heady time. It was exciting. I was writing some of the best stuff, you know, my stuff that was creating waves.
Yes.
My first lesbian article. My first articles, and the articles that got me the job, were my George Eliot novels, articles. Mm-hmm. And I wrote, you know, several, about four or so articles right in a row, and I got tenure. That's how I got tenure. But then I started writing lesbian articles, and I wrote one article that was published. I gave it as a paper mm-hmm. in 1979 at NWSA, and then it got published by, I think, 1981 in Feminist Studies. It was called What Has Never Been, Lesbian Feminist Criticism or Literary Criticism. And it was this overview of all this lesbian feminist criticism that had been coming out since the late 70s. And it was encyclopedic and synthesizing, which is kind of like what my style is, my mark on the profession, really. Mm-hmm. And it was, you know, like it became the article, and it still is. I am in the Norton Anthology of Literary Criticism.
That's
how many
wonderful.
People are in the Norton Anthology of Literary Criticism?
That's terrific.
You know, I am right after Oscar Wilde.
That's wonderful.
I mean, it's unbelievable. And it was that article. That article has been reprinted and reprinted almost.
Yeah.
I mean, there are times I've told people, no, you may not reprint it in that book, because that book doesn't have anything to do with this.
Mm-hmm.
You just want a token lesbian piece, and this is not the right one. Do your homework and find the right one.
Mm-hmm.
So
that's
that made a tremendous impact. I wrote a piece on teaching lesbian studies courses. I wrote a lot of things that were the first ones, and so I made my career really, really quickly. I mean, by 1981, 1982, I was one of the top lesbian scholars,
right,
or critics, you know.
Right.
So people know me.
And did the university, in other words, you were able to go to different conferences?
Yeah.
And
oh, yeah, yeah.
That's terrific.
Well, we got $500 a year towards conference expenses, and it's still, I think, $500 a year 30 years later. Yeah, that was never an issue. I went to 2, 3, 4 conferences a year.
That's terrific.
So, and I got lots of support from the university. I mean, I got release time, I got grants, I got whatever, pretty much whatever I needed.
So it doesn't sound like there was a struggle or mm-hmm. anything. It was a good thing.
For me, it was, my career was a dream career.
Huh.
I had no trouble at the university at all. This place nurtured me. I had no trouble getting promoted. I had no trouble getting tenure.
And they also clearly recognized the wonderful work that you were doing. You were getting awards and honors and
yes.
all along.
Yes,
yeah.
I was very, I think I was recognized as one of the, you know, outstanding scholars
right.
at the university.
Right, and it
yeah.
continued. That's marvelous.
Yeah, yeah.
And
I have also always got elected to anything that I wanted.
Hmm.
You know, committees and things like that. I can't say enough about this place, about the administration, and about the about most of the faculty, and even the ones that I've struggled with and fought with. For the most part, I felt that they've treated me like they've seen me as a peer, as somebody they respect.
That's very, very good. That's where we are. So, all right, I'll put it on. What else was happening in the 80s?
Well, in addition to the academic work and teaching lesbian studies, we were also beginning to develop some gay and lesbian presence on the campus.
Mm-hmm.
Now, my memory of dates is very fuzzy on this mm-hmm. one, so I'm going to have a hard time. But sometime in the 80s, and I think it must have been mid to late, I honestly cannot remember, the gay and lesbian faculty and staff began to get together. It started first with social stuff. We had this little salon that met once a month or something like that. People would just get together. It was primarily mostly the men, and I think it was for them mostly a kind of social club. For there weren't as many out There weren't that many out lesbians initially, although that switched, interestingly. And most of us knew each other already through women's studies. But so we started with that, and then we began to have a little bit of a political focus. We created something we called GLIC, Gay and Lesbian Issues Committee. Terrible name, terrible acronym, but it's what we used. And we would meet for lunch periodically and try to do things. The climate in the 80s was not real open.
Right.
It was open within women's studies and academically. It's not like there were very many other open gay people on campus. I should say, let me tell you, this is going back a little bit, but I just want to acknowledge like two anecdotes that are sort of demonstrate kind of the contradictory nature of being gay or lesbian at that time. The first is when I came for my interview in 1978, I was interviewed by the associate dean of the college, who was Elsie Adam. And Elsie had actually been involved with women's studies. She had edited an anthology some years before, but she was the associate dean at the time. And I walked into her office, and there was a poster on the wall advertising gay and lesbian literature, a course that had been offered already. And I thought, the dean's office, associate dean's office, advertising gay and lesbian literature.
Yeah.
I could be happy here.
Yeah.
And as it happened, that course had been taught as a special topics course by a professor in the English department named Carl Keller. Carl really has the honor of, you know, having taught the first gay course.
Oh.
Now, Carl was, his focus was much, much more on men, but still. And he was just a wonderful guy. He was funny, flamboyant, outrageously gay. He was a former Mormon who had come out in adulthood.
Oh boy.
And all of that. And so Carl was sort of the first openly gay person and was very, very open about it. But then on the other hand, the other anecdote I will tell you, and I will not say the name because I don't want to embarrass her, but the first week that I was on campus, this is after I'd been hired and I came in the fall of 78, somebody came to my door, a faculty member who was in her second year in another department, another college, came in to introduce herself. She had been involved with women's studies, so she came to introduce herself. She closed the door and she said, "I'm a lesbian too."
Oh.
Now, these days, we're best friends.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, I remind her of this sometimes and she laughs about it because, of course, now we're all so open.
Right.
But, you know, there really was in the 70s.
Absolutely.
Is this going to ruin my career? I mean, Carl was a full professor. This person was an untenured assistant professor.
Mm-hmm.
So it still was a very, very tentative time. So during the 80s, we were trying to change that climate, in part by the work we were doing as academics, but also I think this was in the early 90s, jumping ahead a little bit, but we developed resolutions that I introduced into the Senate on support for domestic partners and to get the ROTC off campus because of the gay military.
I read about that, yeah.
So those were the kinds of things that we were doing, and we were just trying to create more of an open environment. And eventually, you know, then a little bit later in the 90s, my colleague Edith Benkov, who is now actually has my position, the one that I just retired from, Edie and I began to work on creating gay and lesbian studies courses. I was still teaching lesbian studies, lesbian courses in women's studies and in English, but we created the first gay and lesbian course in the mid-90s.
Okay.
And eventually created enough course, we started the work towards putting together a minor, which now exists.
Oh, wonderful.
So it was nice. You know, I mean, I started the work back in the 80s and 90s, and then we kept picking, and other people have picked up, and now there's a minor, and I hear they're talking about now a major, which is just
that's
fabulous.
Wonderful. Yeah.
Yeah, so that was all, you know, really, really good stuff. Really good stuff. Mm-hmm. I never felt the least bit stifled as a lesbian on this campus. Not on this campus. And I'll give you an example. This is my Tom Day story.
Okay.
And I came the same year as President Day, and he was an interesting character. I mean, he had his politics were diametrically opposite to mine. They both not just politically but socially, culturally. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, you wouldn't let condoms on campus and things like that. Okay. But I always liked, I always thought that he had the best interests of the university at heart, and I really felt that he was developing this university, he and others, you know, to make it a really important, his values were the same values that I had about mm-hmm. the importance of research and scholarship and, you know, quality.
Right.
Well, I don't remember the year. I wish I could remember the year, and it would be easy enough to track it down. It was the year that Lynn Cheney was the head of the NEH, and the NEH put she set a policy that would deny any grants to gay or lesbian research. I think that this was precipitated by something that had happened with the NEA. And with some grants that the conservatives called into question. So it was around sometime in the probably early 90s. Well, the university invited the same year Lynn Cheney to be the commencement speaker.
Oh my.
I was furious. I wrote Tom Day a letter. And I said, I feel that this is a slap in my face as a member of this community, that if I applied for a grant, I would not be allowed to have a grant. How can we bring somebody in who has these policies? This is like saying I'm not a part of this San Diego State community.
Mm-hmm.
Tom wrote me a 3-page single-spaced letter back. He disagreed with me. He explained his reasons why, but he took 3 pages to explain what his position, his beliefs were about this.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't dismiss me. Took me seriously. And I have always respected him.
Mm-hmm.
I respected him before, but I respected him, and I have stood up for him after mm-hmm. the tough times in 1992. This must have been
before that
in the 80s. It must have been in the 80s. It was well before that.
Yeah.
So
that's very interesting.
It's he had the ability to disagree
mm-hmm.
fiercely and say exactly what he thought about something without being dismissive of another person's thoughts. So I just felt respected.
And was, respect,
that's
yeah.
That's what it was. I just felt he, you know, showed
yeah.
respect.
Yeah.
So that's my Tom Day story.
That's a good story.
The early 80s through my book.
Okay. Okay.
Okay.
Tell me more about what you were thinking and writing and in the early 80s and mm-hmm. onward.
Okay. I think that what I was most interested in as a scholar was trying to map the dimensions of this field of lesbian literary and literary theory. I mean, I was pretty much focused in literature. And if you look at my work, it is pretty much it is this synthesizing and organizing type and.
Mm-hmm.
I saw a lot of, I really believed that we were creating a cultural movement, a community of writers, scholars, activists, mm-hmm. that this was something unique and wonderful that was happening. And I also was somewhat, I think, deluded that we all thought the same. And I think that was one of the dilemmas or one of the problems that my generation of lesbian feminists had, that there was a certain, this is who we are, and we know who we are, and we're all the same, and mm-hmm. there is no dissension. And all of that began to disintegrate mm-hmm. in the 1980s, as it had to, because it just wasn't true. It wasn't mm-hmm. real. I mean, everybody has a tendency to project their reality as the only reality. Mm-hmm. You have to constantly be aware of what you're doing and fighting against that. And, you know, initially we weren't so good at that. So as I'm writing, I mean, I would write things and then I would get kind of gently criticized sometimes and sometimes not so gently confronted. And it was hard. It was a lot of growing pains through the 80s. Mm-hmm. But I'm very proud of the work I did. I wrote some really fine articles.
Right.
And they were published in a lot of really good places. I made lots and lots of good academic colleagues, friends. They became friends and all of that. And mm-hmm. And then I began to write, to decide there was time to write a book. And I always thought that, I had thought that I would be writing a book on George Eliot, but by the mid-80s, that seemed so long ago and far away. Mm-hmm. And so what I decided I wanted to do was write a book about all this fiction that was being written mm-hmm. in the late 70s and mostly in the 80s.
Yeah.
It was 70s and 80s. Mm-hmm. And I just saw something that was, I saw it as representative of this community. Mm-hmm. And it took a very long time. I began the book, I actually began working on the book just prior to my first sabbatical. I had a sabbatical 1985-86 for that academic year. And I had been collecting all these books, and I'd been reading them, and I'd been taking notes on them. So mm-hmm. I had notebooks full of reading notes. Mm-hmm. And my partner and I decided that we wanted to spend my sabbatical year in Europe, mm. and that the way to do that, and that we wanted to get a van, a camper. Mm-hmm. And so we bought a Volkswagen van and picked it up in Europe. And we spent a year, almost a year, I think it was a little short of a year, traveling around Europe.
Oh, how nice.
Camping for most of the time.
Great.
Except for the winter, we spent 2 months in Portugal. And during that period of time, I kind of wrote the first draft, a very, very, very rough draft of my book.
That's wonderful.
I mean, mostly it was commentary on my notes. So what I did was I had another notebook, and I still have all these notebooks, and I don't know what to do with them. I should probably give them to an archive or something. Mm-hmm.
It sounds like they should maybe come here.
Maybe they should. Maybe they should go to the Lesbian Hearst archives.
Okay.
I'm not sure about this yet.
Yeah.
So I had my reading notes on all these books, and then I did interpretive writing on them. Mm-hmm. And then when we came back at the end of the sabbatical, then I actually started working on the book. So it began 1984-85 mm-hmm. with the research. It wasn't published till 1990, and I actually stopped writing it. It went into production very, very quickly, so I stopped writing it around 1989. I mean, I wrote, included books up through 89. Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things that happened was that the theoretical landscape changed during that period, and I didn't keep up with it. I began to be aware of it mm-hmm. when I was already well into writing the first draft of my book.
Okay.
And you begin to see the influence of it in the later chapters of the book. I begin to incorporate some of the post-structuralist theory mm-hmm. that had already kind of rooted itself in literary criticism. By 1990, when the book was actually published, you know, people like Judith Butler had, I think, Gender Trouble was published in 1989. So, and everybody was doing Lacan and Foucault and all, and I hadn't really kept up with that. So the reaction to my book was kind of interesting. It was a little bifurcated. On the one hand, a lot of regular readers read this book. People who read the novels read the book.
Okay.
And they loved it.
Yeah.
Some of the writers wrote me and said, I didn't realize what I was doing until I read what you said about my work, and now I see how it fits in. I mean, that's some of the best stuff you could ever have anybody say.
That's wonderful.
On the other hand, the academic theorists, and by now, women's studies and even lesbian studies is kind of really institutionalized into the literary critical world. They really were very critical of the book. And there was the very first review that came out, the first review of my book was in The Nation. Hmm. Oh, my God. I mean, who gets reviewed in The Nation? And it was partly positive, but there was so much that was negative. Mm-hmm. And it was all because I wasn't writing in the discourse. Mm. And although I had thought that it was clear that what I was talking about was the vision of a generation, and then how that vision had kind of become a myth, because I write a lot about the myth of the community, but this reviewer and it set the tone for a lot of other reviews. Because I also am upfront about placing myself as part of that. I mean, I was in that community.
Right.
Didn't see that I was being self-critical. Or, you know, that they just saw that I was trying to be a myth-maker rather than to explore myth-making.
Huh.
And I was also using concepts that I think are more congenial, frankly, to anthropology. The whole notion of myth. And cultural myths, rather than discourse.
No, that's what
narrative.
Right, that's what interests me. Yeah.
So my book was not as well received as I would have liked. Mm-hmm. And when you've spent 6 years of your life, and this is to be your crowning achievement, it was a little hard.
That's hard.
So I had very mixed feelings, and that I must say began my beginning of a little bit of a retreat from academia. But it doesn't really show up for 10 years or so, because during the 90s I continued to write. But I was primarily writing reflective pieces.
Okay.
I no longer felt that I had anything new and original to say because the discourse had just gone in a different direction for me.
Yeah.
And it was not something I was interested in. It was like, it would be like if right now, at age 63, I tried to teach myself a new language. Mm-hmm. I would never be fluent in it.
Right.
I felt at that point, by 1990, post-structuralist language was a foreign language I could not be fluent in. And queer theory just wasn't where I was, either politically or personally. And I just don't believe that theories are right or wrong. I don't think theories have a reality to them. I think that they are expressions of a zeitgeist.
Mm-hmm.
Well, lesbian feminism was the expression of my zeitgeist.
Yeah.
I couldn't make myself a different person, didn't want to make myself a different person. Queer theory never resonated for me. So I never really, a little bit here and there, but always kind of as a, you know, queer theory as a second language kind of approach. Mm-hmm. So I was kind of like a little bit on the outside. I still got lots of invitations to come and speak. I still got lots of people asking me to write things about women's studies, about lesbian studies, about all of that. I did a lot of that. Mm-hmm. But I don't feel that after Safe Sea of Women, I don't feel like I produced anything that was new. I was primarily shaping something, things from the past, mm-hmm. which has a purpose.
Absolutely.
And I still feel, and I began to write reflective essays about my own career,
right.
and my own
and your vision
life.
And your own way of looking at, well, that's what I was interested in, you sharing, if you wish, more about that article about being Jewish, a literary critic.
Yeah, I wrote three what one might call autobiographical essays.
Okay.
And that was one of them. Why did I write that? Well, it was an invitation. I got an invitation to contribute an article to this book, People of the Book, which was going to be a collection of essays by Jewish intellectuals.
Okay.
And once again, it always amazes me when I am considered to be in the same club as other people. It's like, are you sure you're talking to the right Bonnie Zimmerman? That's, you know, this thing about I'm in the Norton Anthology, or I got reviewed in The Nation, and I am there with, I mean, there are some people in other people in this collection that is like, are you serious? You want me? Okay. So I definitely want to do it, and I thought it would be a very interesting way of reflecting upon myself as a Jew, which I had never done.
Mm-hmm.
And I write that in the book, that it was, I think, 1995 or 1996. That's when the article came out, the book came out. And in my whole academic career, 25 years, I had never written a single thing about being Jewish. I even point out that in The Safe Sea of Women, mm-hmm. when it's right in the article, at the beginning, in the introduction, I say something about, this is my place in the universe. I'm white, I'm middle class,
yes.
I'm a feminist, I'm a blah, blah,
right,
blah.
Right, right.
But I'm not a Jew. At the very end, at the very end of the book, I do the same thing, but now I'm a Jewish. And I say metaphorically, from the beginning of my journey to the end of my journey, I became a Jew. So I reflect upon that.
Yeah.
It's because of the deep conflicts, because this is highly personal. It's hard for me to talk about, especially because it's connected. It's my family.
Yeah.
It's the only part of my life and my identity, my academic life, that implicates my family. I grew up in a secular Jewish family.
Okay.
And in order to be who I was, I had to reject who they were,
mm-hmm.
and some of that rejection was rejection of that common place, middle class, Jewish, you know, out of the ghetto into the suburb, kind of growing more and more conservative. I mean, a really formative experience for me in my high school days mm-hmm. was fighting with my family about the civil rights movement.
Oh.
And that the everyday, ordinary racism of middle-class Jews was so appalling to me.
Yeah.
Still is.
Yeah. Oh.
And so
today,
shaping myself in reaction to my family meant not denying my Jewishness, but simply minimizing it.
Mm-hmm.
Then I went to Indiana University where there were no Jews.
Oh.
I think out of a campus of 30,000 students, there were about 300 Jews in the 60s.
Okay.
And I encountered anti-Semitism.
Oh.
And then I got into the left, and the left was anti-Semitic.
Mm.
They called it anti-Zionist. They called it anti-Israel, but it really was very easy to mistake for anti-Semitism. It made me uncomfortable, but I was also very this was part of the rejection of the family as well, because I mean, for years I couldn't have a conversation with my father about anything.
I can.
And for years, even after we resolved that, I avoided any conversation about Israel.
Mm-hmm.
I'm still a little iffy. I don't always. Then I also, during my college days, I think this was more when I came back to Chicago, my brother became Orthodox, my younger brother. So then there was Orthodoxy in the family. So it was all kind of a mishmash of things that I didn't want to deal with.
Yeah.
So I just didn't think about it, and I didn't write about it.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, at the same time, I am intensely Jewish.
Mm-hmm.
I'm Jewish in my physical looks. Nobody is going to doubt that I'm Jewish. I'm Jewish in my mannerisms.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I have a Jewish personality, Jewish character, and I love the history of Jews.
Mm-hmm.
I am deeply and deeply Jewish, and I have become more Jewish over the years.
That's very interesting. Yeah.
Well, so this article is about coming to terms with all of that. How can you be a feminist and a lesbian? I had such issues with my family over that. Mostly they were my issues, but they were real. I mean, my mother could not handle it. My mother was, she used to say, okay, so you're a lesbian, so what will it matter to me, because I'm going to kill myself.
Oh, that's like this.
The Jewish
like
mother
Seinfeld
suicide.
But
it was teach them in Jewish mother school.
No, I understand.
I know you do, every Jewish woman understands this.
I do.
But coming to think about all
Jewish
of this.
Jewish mother school, I love
absolutely.
It.
Absolutely. That turned out to be one of the most satisfying articles that I wrote, and one
That's
of
good.
My favorites. Now, the interesting thing about it is that about half of it is very personal, and about half of it is an analysis of a novel. And I really think that the analysis of the novel was a way of not getting too deeply into my personal stuff.
Sure. Which,
I ended with with an anecdote. And the other thing is, it was a different style of writing for me. It was, I think, the first time that I incorporated anecdotal personal stuff into a academic piece. So it was really, really nice developing a new style of writing. And one of the nice things about it is that I gave this article to my brother and sister-in-law to read.
Oh, my.
Because after my book was published was when I, came out to my whole family.
Oh.
My sister knew. I told my mother. My father, I had not told.
Oh, boy.
My brother, I hadn't told. And some of my other relatives, So in preparation for the book being published, I mean, for years I'm telling them I'm working on a book. What's your book? Oh, it's feminist literature. It's just, that's a whole other issue.
Yeah.
So I told my brother, and he said, well, it's against the laws. I might have a harder time if you were, a male, because it's so explicitly forbidden. It's not quite clear, with women. And he says, besides, It's whether you're a lesbian or and you don't keep the Sabbath, kind of the same, you know? Anyway, we really have become so close. And
oh, that's wonderful.
I end the article with an anecdote that my brother tells me about how one day my brother and sister-in-law are in a bookstore, and they decide to look for my book, and they find my book, and they start reading my book.
Oh.
And they laugh about what people must think to see these, you know, the two frummies with the safe sea of women, you know. And it, to me, that was the reconciliation.
Yeah.
And it was not a false reconciliation. Because
yeah.
One of the things that I talk about in that article
yeah.
is that it's easy to gloss sure. over contradictions.
Oh, yeah.
By saying, well, I'm going to redefine Judaism. Well, that's not so easy. And I guess there's a part of me that if I were deeply religious, I think I'd be Orthodox because I'm kind of like a true believer in some ways.
Mm-hmm.
So I've never been able to just say, well, it doesn't really matter. It mm-hmm. does matter. But what matters is you have to learn how to live with contradictions, not to get rid of contradictions, but to live with them.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a good article.
I'm going to read it. It sounds really good.
Yeah,
and I look forward
to
it.
It's an interesting one because it's kind of melancholy throughout, but then there's a sort of a positive feeling at the end. And by now, I'm so close to my family. I'm so connected with them all. My father and my brother flew out here for my retirement party.
Oh, how
surprised
wonderful.
Me. And everybody, you know, it's just everybody accepts my, it's just such a change in the culture.
That's so great.
Yeah.
How wonderful
yeah.
to have
yeah,
that.
Yeah, I sometimes say it all happened, it really began to change when my partner and I bought a house. And my mother and my father thought, oh, thank God, she's normal. She's going to settle
she has
down.
A house.
Yeah, all right, so it's with a woman. But at least...
That's right.
You know, so they won't have children, which is a good thing because it's a mixed marriage and who, you know, but anyway, so...
Got it. Oh, my. Well,
so, as I said, I wrote these reflective pieces.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote something about reflecting back on that whole period of, you know, adamant belief mm-hmm. when you just, and how cruel we were to each other back in the 70s. We were very cruel to each other. And then this piece that I wrote about being, you know, a lesbian and my lesbian journey. And those were very, very satisfying things to write. And I did a couple of other anthologies, collections of articles, which is also something that I found to be a very satisfying experience as becoming an editor. I moved really from being a writer. I didn't write so much after the mid-90s,
mm-hmm.
but I edited 3 books during that period.
Yeah.
And that was a whole other, that I guess goes back to the Chinese restaurant story. That ability to, you know, put
mm-hmm.
together the needs
right.
and put it together in a satisfying meal.
Yeah.
So the New Lesbian Studies and Professions of Desire. Professions of Desire was really interesting because it was the first thing I'd ever done in collaboration with a man. And it was, you know, a wonderful experience. Became very close friends with George. And, you know, and then culminating with the Encyclopedia, which is... You know, really, when you think about it, an encyclopedia?
I know.
You put together an encyclopedia?
Right.
Yes, I did.
That's terrific.
That's
great.
Another incredible experience, and one that took 4 or 5 years of my, you know, that was the focus of my work for.
Yeah, it is wonderful that when you reflect back at what you do, step by step, you
yes.
can do these things,
yes.
and that's
yes.
a whole wonderful
yes.
thing.
And then it was very satisfying to say, and now I'm done. I'm done. I've done everything that I want to do. I've written every article I want to write.
Wow.
I have I do not wish to write anymore.
While you were doing this kind of writing, and it was, what, the 90s and into 2000, you changed your role, or your role changed at San Diego State University, because you got involved in heading up, you went into administration.
That was not until 2000.
When? The 90s
was really a period of, between the mid-80s and through the 90s was really my research and writing period.
Okay.
I did some administration because I was chairing the department, but that was not really,
okay.
That's not, I never stopped writing during the years that I was chairing
okay.
the department. And I got much more involved in university governance. I did get involved
which is
in
what I
university
recall
governance.
Reading, right.
I was on committees.
Right.
And then I started serving in the Senate in 1997.
Correct.
But I didn't do very much in the Senate until 99. So
okay.
I was much more involved in the National Women's Studies Association. That was the major
okay.
focus of my sort of service mm-hmm. work. And I was a major player in the NWSA up through around 2000.
Okay.
But it definitely, I knew that I had a pretty strong sense that the encyclopedia was going to be my last piece of work. And
mm-hmm.
I think that was published in 2001.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember. I knew that I had squeezed every last drop of lesbian, feminist, anything out of me. There was nothing new. Even the last couple of articles that I wrote that got published in the 2000s, a couple of pieces in anthologies like the one I'm going to speak about tomorrow on women's studies, the history of women's studies.
Yeah. Yeah.
Even there, I felt that I was repeating myself. I was very close to repeating myself.
Mm-hmm.
And I had seen too many academics do that.
Right.
And I didn't want to do it. So
yeah.
It was really clear to me that I was either going to have to break some new territory and go into a new research direction.
Mm.
And I hadn't the vaguest idea what that could be.
Mm-hmm.
Or I was going to have to do something else. And I thought that the something else was going to be more governance service. I was also, I assumed I would continue teaching, although I was beginning to also burn out a little bit with teaching.
Mm-hmm.
So the Senate stuff became a good outlet for me.
Well, tell us more about the Senate.
Well, I'd been briefly in the Senate, actually only for a semester way in the past, but then I just was never interested in that. I had been on committees, but university-wide committees, but I wasn't really interested in it. But then somebody coerced me into putting my name up for nomination, because they were always desperate. I mean, nobody wanted to be in the Senate. So I finally, it was more like, oh God, I owe the university this, or I probably more likely I owe so-and-so. I think I know who it was. And so I agreed to be in the Senate.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd say those first two years, I don't think I really participated all that much. I rarely spoke. I mean, I'd listen to these people, and they know Robert's Rules of Order, and they parliamentary procedure, and they got all the everything.
Yeah,
anything
yeah.
that goes on, they've got something to say. I don't have anything to say about it. What do I care about this issue or that issue? I really was not. And in fact, I have looked back at the minutes of the meetings, and I rarely said anything. I was not very active. But then my friend Pat Huckle became chair of the Senate in 1998.
Okay.
And Pat was convinced that I was the future, and she was going to make me be the future. She decided that I was going to succeed her. And because there, she didn't see anybody else. I mean, it was one of those times where the old guard was beginning to drop out, and it was not clear who the new people were going to be. And there, anyway.
Yeah.
So Pat wanted me to be the next Senate chair, and in order to do that, she created a committee for me, a task force for me. It was on off-campus centers, and it was a hot topic then, and it periodically keeps coming up.
Hmm.
What are we going to do? This was back when it looked like San Diego State was going to expand exponentially forever, and we were never going to, where were we going to go? We didn't have any room here, so where were we going to go? And one of the theories was, one of the proposals was to create off-campus centers, like little mini-universities.
Oh.
So the Senate created a task force to look into this, and Pat made me the chair of it. Well, what that meant was that we did reports, and I got up in front of the Senate and made reports.
Ah.
So I got visibility. That's how we did it. And she began to mentor me. She began to tell me, this is how, show me how she would do everything. And lo and behold, 2001, they nominated me for Senate chair, and it wasn't, there's no election for chair. I mean, whoever gets, you only put one person up. I became the Senate chair, and it was two extremely shall we say, dynamic years. There were a lot of fireworks during my Senate term. I guess there always are, but actually there weren't. After the 2 years I had were two really difficult years.
What?
There was stuff going on. Not stuff that I really want to talk
okay.
about. But there was stuff going on, and I learned a lot. And mm-hmm. I was challenged in ways that I developed skills I didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know I had, but I built them. I think I was a good Senate chair. I don't think I was one of the great Senate chairs. I mean, the 90s was really the period of really great Senate chairs, including Pat. And I don't think there have been Senate chairs like Pat or Gene Lamke or Ray Bodie or but then everybody looks back, you know, it's the golden age thing. Oh, yeah, it used to be better.
Yeah, yeah.
But I would not put myself in that same category. But I was a good chair, and being a Senate chair, it's a faculty role. You know, the concept behind the Senate is one of shared governance, which is the sharing of governance between the faculty and the administration. And the Senate chair is the faculty,
mm-hmm.
so you're the head of the faculty. I'll tell you, the very first thing that I had to do as Senate chair?
Yeah.
9/11. The first Senate meeting was scheduled for 9/11.
Oh, well, that's
so immediately,
momentous.
What do we do? Move the meeting? Do we have a resolution? What should the resolution say? As Senate Chair, I spoke at organized the memorial or whatever we did, you know, so there was this stuff. So that was like the very first thing. And there were things all the way through those 2 years that there was a lot of turmoil. So anyway, I got a very high profile, and I also learned a lot about how the university, you get a different view. When you're a faculty member, and I've said this many times, when you are a faculty member, you primarily see the university and experience the university through your department.
Sure.
Then you become a department chair. Then you experience the university through your college. You begin to see, oh, my department is not the only department. Everybody has needs.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody has
a
perspective.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's only when you go to the and do Senate stuff that you begin to see the university as a university. And being the Senate chair, you get to do that in conjunction with the top administration. You meet regularly with the provost. You meet
mm-hmm.
regularly with the president. You meet with the vice presidents for, you know, various divisions. And you just get that whole sense of the university. And I knew, as many Senate chairs have had the same experience, once you are the chair of the Senate, it's really hard to step back and just be a faculty member again. Uh-huh. So I figured that my next step had to be administration, because what was I going to do? I wasn't chair of the department anymore, and I wasn't going to be chair of the department. I was the graduate advisor, and I got a lot of satisfaction out of running the graduate program. But what was I going to do? Mm-hmm. And I wasn't going to do research anymore, because I couldn't think of anything I wanted to research. Mm-hmm. And I remember a very interesting conversation that I had with Nancy Marlin, Provost Marlin, and I said, I'm interested in administration. Let me step back, because
sure.
I do have another anecdote.
Oh,
okay,
good.
So here's an anecdote.
Okay.
It would have been 1995 or 1996. No. It would have been 1996 or 1997. Steve Weber was the newly president. The provost, academic vice president, had retired. Ethan Singer was the acting associate vice president. This was before Nancy came. Ethan called me into his office. I did not know Ethan at all. And he said that we had a new president. The president was looking for people, you know, and to get involved. And Ethan thought that I would be a good person to have in the academic affairs. Would I like to come and work for him? And I said, absolutely not. I am not the least bit interested in administration. Mm. I wouldn't be an administrator over my dead body, all of that.
Yeah.
And so I turned him down.
Mm.
And I think that it was the right thing to do at that time, because I don't think I was ready.
Right.
And I don't know that I would have been good at it. I think I would have failed, and then I would have never gone
on.
So, fast forward about 5 years.
It was the time.
So, and I had a conversation with Nancy about it, and I said, I think I'm interested in administration and, like, maybe being a dean. And she said, you'd be a very good dean. But two things. First, you have to pay attention to how your face is showing your emotions. She said, I can read your face. I know exactly what you're thinking all the time. And as an administrator, you have to have a blank face. Secondly, you have to move. If you want to go into administration, you have to be willing to move, because you're not going to, there's no ladder at the university, within the university.
Oh.
I wasn't willing to move.
Yeah.
We were happy here. I wanted to be in San Diego. So I thought, all right, it's not going to happen. And then in the fall of 2002, late summer, fall 2002, two jobs came available, were announced. One was Dean of the College of Arts and Letters. And the other was Associate Vice President for Faculty Affairs.
Mm-hmm.
I really was interested in being the dean of the college, but I knew that it was not going to happen. That they would be looking outside, and because there is, you know, you want fresh people to come in, and I also knew that there were some things that I didn't have. I didn't have budget experience. I didn't have development experience.
Yeah,
I was smart. I read the situation. And as Senate Chair, I actually attended the first meeting of the search committee when the president said, we're looking for somebody from outside the university. Yeah. So, okay, I knew. So I decided to apply for the Faculty Affairs. Somebody pushed me into it.
Mm-hmm.
But I had been thinking about it. And I hadn't really thought about it, but it turned out that I was exactly the right person for it. I had exactly the right combination of experiences and skills and actually the right temperament. And so I got it.
Terrific.
And I was scared. I mean, there were things I was dealing with, collective bargaining, grievances, disciplinary actions, mm-hmm. lawyers. I'd never done any of that. I had to go
But you could
buy
order
clothes.
The Chinese food.
I could order the Chinese food. I was good at that.
Absolutely.
And the biggest, but seriously, the biggest deal is that I had to get a professional wardrobe because even,
But you didn't have to have skirts.
Not skirts. No. We were long past skirts.
Right.
And those 7 years in the position, I just really pleased that I had that experience.
Oh, it's terrific.
It was a wonderful, I loved my job. I loved, I won't say that I loved every minute of it because I had to deal with some really horrendous stuff.
Probably, yeah.
But I think I got more satisfaction out of that role than any other role that I've had in the university.
That's terrific.
I know, it seems so surprising. And the only regret I have is that I hadn't gone into administration about 10 years earlier.
That's very interesting.
I mean, it's only minor regret. It's not a big deal. But I think I would have liked to have been a provost.
Mm-hmm.
But I would have had to move into administration in my 40s,
yeah.
I think, in
yeah.
order to actually have that, because I didn't want to work to 70.
Mm-hmm.
And I really didn't want to move around the country. So.
Yeah.
So it turned out to be perfect.
Well, that's great.
Yeah.
That's great. Well, it certainly is a fascinating pathway that you've had.
You know, I think that it's always, all stories obviously are retrospective, and all histories are obviously, this is a tautology, they're retrospective, but there's a certain profundity to this because while you're experiencing your life, you really don't know what the narrative is. It's only after it's over. It's why Aristotle says the only happy life is at the end. It's only when you look back mm-hmm. at the very end that you can say somebody was happy or somebody was not. I reached the end of my career. There were some parts of it that were really very unpleasant, and there's one big event part of it I won't talk about at all. So it wasn't perfect. It was not always happy, but and there were clearly things that I wish could have happened differently. But overall, I look back at, if I go back, let's say 32 years at San Diego, but really it goes back further than that, even to the beginning of women's studies in 1969.
Mm-hmm.
I can't think of very many people who have had a more well-rounded and satisfying mm-hmm. and productive career.
It's terrific.
I feel like I made a difference.
Right.
That I've left a mark. I'm proud of what I did. I took pleasure. I created
Absolutely.
Good friends.
It's terrific.
And I'm a happy person.
That's an accomplishment.
Yeah.
It is.
Let's try.
All right.
Let's try.
Okay.
So I guess we're at the point now where I have retired. And
yes.
First of all, I want to say that it is an amazing achievement to have come to this point in one's life, and especially since I think all of us probably feel this way. I still think I must be 25, so how is it that I possibly can be retiring? And it's also a fabulous, I guess it's just a privilege and an honor and a great big piece of luck to even be able to retire these days. I am acutely aware of what a privilege we have to have retirement plans. You know, that is something that I thank San Diego State and California State University for. It's been interesting. Now, I've been retired for about 4 months, and I've never been as busy, and I think a lot of people say that, but I don't have any great desire to go back to anything that I've done in my career. A lot of academics look forward to writing and doing more research. I don't. I really don't. I have said what I have to say, and I no longer wish to write. I'm not highly active in the university. That could change. I could see getting involved in certain things. I speak occasionally in a class or would come to, you know, some events. I support the university, you know, in financially in certain ways and all. But it feels like after a very long career in which my work was really the central focus of my life, especially these past 7 years with the 9-to-5, well, much more than 9-to-5, but, you know, 5 days a week, regular job, no long summers, summer breaks and all of that, in which I've really focused on work, and that's been the priority. What's really nice is now shifting that priority to my partner and myself and what we want out of life, what she wants out of life, because for so much of the past 30 years that we've been together, I've put my work first, and you kind of have to. So, which is not to say that we haven't had all kinds of wonderful experiences, and she really enjoyed being part of the women's studies community as well. Not so much the administrators' community. She never really liked going to any of the administrators' parties and stopped doing it. But now that's the priority, and it's something different. It's much more, I'm reflecting more on other parts of myself and who I am and who I want to be in these however many years I have left. And it is kind of weird to look forward and realize that the biggest part of your life is now past. So, and also to focus more on simple pleasures and the dailiness of life. And when you're working, you just don't, I didn't at least, notice the dailiness of life. But, you know, there are things like, oh, going shopping and cleaning the house. And how did I ever deal with all of the repair people? Well, I actually didn't, you know. So it's a very different rhythm. It's a fabulous thing to get up in the morning when you want to get up instead of when you have to get up. It's a fabulous thing to say, I don't have to cram all the pleasure into the weekend. It's wonderful to say, today is a bright and sunny day, I will play. And tomorrow is a cold and rainy day, I'll stay in and cuddle up and read a book.
Yeah.
So I think that I highly recommend retirement to everybody. So that's pretty much, I think that pretty much brings it all. I don't feel like my life is at an end, but I do feel that my career is at an end, and now I'm doing something else, which is called living.
Wonderful. Well, it certainly has been a privilege and a pleasure to conduct this oral history with you, and thank you very much.
You're welcome.